Welcome to the Robotics Brief. I'm Hax.
And I'm Sam. Glad to be here with you.
Today, we're seeing something really interesting, Sam, which is less about robots getting smarter in a traditional sense, and more about them getting better at explaining how they're smart.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. It feels like a lot of these papers are addressing the black box problem, but not necessarily by opening the box directly. They're finding ways for the box to articulate itself, or at least for us to prompt it into articulation.
Precisely. We're seeing models generate their own thought processes, essentially, through a sequence of frames or through carefully structured questions, which is a departure from just getting a final answer. It implies a deeper, more verifiable kind of reasoning.
Or at least a simulated deeper reasoning. I mean, the models are still just predicting the next token, right? Even if that token is a visual representation of a thought. We're designing systems to make them appear to reason more robustly.
So let's start with OpenCoff. Learning to Reason Through Video Generation. This paper introduces chain-of-frame reasoning, which they're positioning as distinct from the traditional chain of thought we've seen in large language models.
Right. Instead of text explaining its steps, it's a sequence of video frames, which honestly sounds pretty intuitive for a robot, doesn't it? A robot navigates by seeing, by processing visual information sequentially.
It does. And the idea that a model could generate a sequence of visual states, essentially a mini-simulation, to arrive at a conclusion is genuinely powerful. It's like it's mentally rehearsing actions or anticipating outcomes.
But is it reasoning, Alex? Or is it just generating a plausible visual sequence that happens to lead to the correct answer? That's my skeptical read. We're still asking a generative model to generate, and then calling that reasoning.
I think the distinction is in the intention of the generation, Sam. If the system is explicitly trained on a dataset designed for reasoning tasks, where the intermediary frames are crucial to the logical progression, that moves it beyond mere plausible generation. The OpenCoff 17K dataset is key here. It's not just general video.
Okay, but how do you verify the causality of that chain of frames? How do you know frame 3 caused frame 4 in a reasoning sense, and it's not just a lucky guess across the whole sequence? That's the part that still feels a bit hand-wavy to me. We're still inferring the why from the what.
I see your point. It's a valid concern about interpretability, even within this new framework. But for me, the very act of generating those intermediate frames, especially when tasked with a complex problem, represents a more structured internal process than just a direct mapping from input to output. It's a step towards explicable intelligence, even if the why isn't fully transparent yet.
It's a step. I'll give you that. It's definitely a more useful kind of output for debugging, if nothing else.
That leads us to Dexverse, which is a modular benchmark for multitask, multi-embodiment, dexterous manipulation. This feels like it's addressing the practical side of making robots actually do things in the real world, across different forms.
Yeah, this is big. For all the talk of general intelligence, most robot manipulation still feels like it's living in isolated sandboxes. Dexverse sounds like it's trying to build a proper playground for dexterous tasks, which is what we need to move beyond highly specialized solutions.
And what struck me, Sam, is the sheer scale they're talking about. 100 tasks, broad range of skills, diverse interaction modes. It's not just more tasks. It's a commitment to varied sensory conditions and robot embodiments. That last part is crucial.
That's the part I really like, multi-embodiment. Because you can have the smartest policy in the world, but if it only works on one specific robotic hand in one specific simulation, it's not really general. This gets at the core of true generalization.
Right. We keep seeing these amazing results, but then you dig in and it's always achieved on a single bipedal robot with specific joint limits in a perfectly simulated environment. Dexverse is pushing back against that limitation, making the benchmark itself a challenge in adaptation.
But 100 tasks, even with all the variations, is still just a sliver of what a human can do with their hands. So while it's a massive improvement over what we have, I'm still wondering if it's broad enough to really foster general purpose policies, or if we'll just end up with policies that are generally good at those 100 tasks.
That's fair, Sam. It's an iterative process, isn't it? But you have to start somewhere, and a benchmark that forces models to consider different hand shapes and control schemes for the same fundamental task is a huge step forward for the field. It makes the results much more transferable, potentially.
Potentially. I mean, it should. But we've seen benchmarks before that promise generalization and then just lead to models that overfit to the benchmark. The devil's always in the details of the data and the evaluation metrics, so I'm optimistic, but with a good dose of skepticism.
Moving to Autopilot VQA, this is another interesting take on reasoning, specifically for autonomous driving. It's about benchmarking vision language models for incident-centric dashcam understanding.
This one is vital, honestly. It's not just about object detection anymore. It's about reasoning about incidents. That's where the rubber meets the road, literally. A model has to understand the context, the implications, the potential dangers.
And the way they've structured it, with structured questions designed around real-world driving incidents, suggests they're really trying to probe for genuine understanding, not just pattern matching. It's moving from, is there a car, to, why did that car swerve?
Yeah, it sounds like they're trying to get at the predictive reasoning, not just what's happening, but what could happen or what should have happened. That's a huge leap for safety-critical systems like autonomous driving.
It is. And the fact that they're focusing on safety-critical incidents means they're not just looking for average performance, but robust performance in the moments that matter most. That's a harder test for these models.
Absolutely. Because a model can be 99% accurate on sunny days with clear roads, but if it fails on the 1% of edge cases that lead to accidents, it's not safe. This benchmark sounds like it's hitting those critical scenarios.
And I think that's where the vision language models really shine here. They allow for a more natural way to ask those complex, nuanced questions about context and intent that simple object detection can't capture. You can ask, was the driver paying attention, in a way you can't with bounding boxes?
Right, but my question is, are the models actually understanding attention, or are they just associating patterns in the video with common linguistic descriptions of attention? Again, it's that reasoning versus sophisticated pattern matching argument. They're still not drivers themselves.
That's a fair challenge, Sam. But if they can consistently answer those questions correctly across a diverse set of real-world incidents, then for practical purposes, they're demonstrating a level of understanding that gets us closer to reliable decision-making. The mechanism of understanding might still be a black box, but the observable behavior is what matters for safety.
For safety, yes, I agree. I just hope we're not overinterpreting what the models are doing just because they can produce human-like answers to human-like questions.
Next up, contact mimic, humanoid object interaction via contact control. This paper is about getting robots to interact with objects using more than just key point tracking. It's explicitly about contact.
Thank God. This is another one that feels like it's bringing things back to reality. Key point tracking alone is useless for physical interaction. You can put your hand in the right place, but if you're not actually gripping the object, you're not doing anything.
Exactly. The example they give, sitting on a chair, wiping a board, those aren't just about reaching a pose. There's a crucial interaction force, a pressure, a physical engagement that key points just don't capture.
And the idea of part-level binary contact commands alongside key point trajectories, that's smart. It's adding a layer of crucial information that makes the robot's interaction physically meaningful. It's not just be here, it's be here and press.
And the contact following rewards they mentioned, Sam, that seems to be the core of the learning here. It explicitly rewards the robot for making and maintaining the right kind of physical contact. That's a fundamentally different learning objective than just minimizing positional error.
It's focusing on the how of the interaction, not just the what. And that's critical for tasks that are inherently about friction, about force, about stability. You can't simulate friction purely with key points.
Which, honestly, I think is where a lot of dexterous manipulation papers often fall short. They show a robot gracefully moving around an object, but not necessarily picking it up robustly or manipulating it with purpose. Contact Mimic seems to directly address that gap.
Yeah, but are they just hard-coding contact rules, or is the robot actually learning when and how much contact is needed? The summary mentions trajectory augmentation scheme aimed at breaking the correlations between key point trajectories and contact labels, which suggests a more nuanced learning. That's what I'd want to see.
That's a good distinction, and the breaking correlations part is key. It implies the system isn't just learning to make contact when its hand is at a certain point, but to learn that contact is an independent objective that needs to be controlled. That's a more sophisticated understanding.
I hope so, because that's what we need for truly robust physical interaction. If you can only learn to sit on one specific chair by making contact at one specific spot, that's not generalization. It needs to understand the concept of sitting on a chair.
And finally, ARDI, autoregressive diffusion with hybrid representation for interactive human motion generation. This is about generating realistic 3D human motions in real time.
This sounds like it's bridging the gap between highly controlled offline motion generation and the kind of fast, responsive motion needed for, say, a digital avatar or a humanoid robot that needs to react in real time.
Exactly. The problem has always been that offline methods offer precision but are slow, and online methods are fast but sacrifice control and often struggle with long horizon goals. ARDI claims to bridge that with a streaming generation framework.
That's a big claim, Alex. Real-time, controlled, and long horizon?
Usually you get to pick two, maybe. The hybrid representation and auto-regressive diffusion parts are probably the secret sauce, allowing it to combine the best of both worlds.
The hybrid representation aspect really caught my attention. It suggests they're encoding motion in a way that allows for both fine-grained control and broader semantic understanding. That's hard to do well.
But for humanoid robotics, this is huge. If you can generate realistic, controlled, interactive human motion in real time, you've got a foundation for incredibly natural human-robot interaction, or even for teaching robots complex, nuanced movements.
It opens up so many possibilities, doesn't it? From realistic simulation environments to more expressive robot behaviors. No longer are robots limited to a library of pre-programmed actions. They can generate novel, contextual motions.
I mean, how much of this is just for animation, and how much is directly applicable to physical robots? Because generating a plausible motion in a simulation is one thing. Getting a real, physical robot to execute that motion without breaking itself or falling over is another entirely.
That's a fair distinction, Sam. The paper explicitly mentions humanoid robotics as an application, but you're right. The leap from perfect simulation to imperfect hardware is always the biggest hurdle. However, having a robust generation engine is a prerequisite for that step. It simplifies the motion planning problem dramatically.
It does. It just feels like a very different problem space, doesn't it? The physics of a rigid body versus the aesthetics of a fluid animation. I just wonder if the compromises made for real-time generation here will make it less useful for the high-fidelity control a robot needs.
So, Sam, if we step back, it feels like a lot of these papers are pushing toward a more actionable intelligence. Whether it's reasoning through frames, or robust contact, or real-time motion, it's about making intelligence manifest in concrete ways.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's less about raw computational power or even raw data volume, and more about how that intelligence is structured and expressed in a way that's useful, verifiable, or directly applicable to physical tasks. It's about grounding the intelligence.
And that grounding often involves better benchmarks, better ways for models to explain themselves, and more granular control over physical interaction. It's not just about getting the right answer, but how you get there.
Which makes sense, because if you can't verify the process, you can't trust the outcome, especially in safety-critical applications.
So the open question, then, is how much of this is genuine, deeper understanding, and how much is just increasingly sophisticated methods of making models appear to understand?
And does it matter, as long as the outcomes are reliable and safe? That's the real conundrum.
That's it for the Robotics Brief this week. I'm Alex.
And I'm Sam. Thanks for listening.
See you next episode. Take care.